The official sermon reading is pretty short. It's not quite as short as last week, but you shall not commit adultery and you shall not bear false witness. We're looking at the seventh and ninth commandments together. And I want to begin with two quotes, one from ancient divinely inspired literature and one from surfer music. The first one is by Yahweh, who said, "It is not good that the man should be alone." And the second one is by Jack Johnson, who said, "Love is the answer, at least for most of the questions in my heart, like why are we here and where do we go and how come it's so hard? It's not always easy, and sometimes life can be deceiving, but I'll tell you one thing. It's always better when we're together." Yahweh and Jack, they're on the same page. They understand that life is better together, that we're meant to live together. And I particularly note Jack's thinking where he says that love is the answer for how come it's so hard. That it's not always easy and life can be deceiving. The easiest life is not the together life. That's not the claim that Jack Johnson is making, and that's not the claim of Scripture. But the best life is the together life. If you leave here this morning with a hankering for a cheeseburger, the easiest option is a McDouble. Right? It costs a dollar, or is it like a dollar and 20 cents now? I don't know. You just go, you go to the drive-thru, it takes a couple minutes, you're in and out. The best option is an Extend-A-Burger from Sky High. It will be much harder. It will cost you 15 times as much. You'll have to go and get one of those buzzers and wait for hours until there's a table available because the secret's out about the best option. But it will be worth it. It is the better life. Life is not easier together, but it's better together. And that understanding is critical to us rightly understanding and living these commandments. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Right? Of all the commandments, these might be the two that are most frequently charged with being kind of arbitrary, kind of silly. I mean, if we're both consenting adults, and we do it safely, and we don't experience lasting psychological damage, what's the problem with a little enjoyable sex? Or if I weigh 215 pounds, plus or minus, depending on how many Girl Scout cookies have been in the house recently, but it's time to renew my driver's license, and I tell the lady at the DMV 205, because I like that number better, what's the big deal? Where's the harm in that? And if it were just rules, if God had just sort of dropped those two tablets out of the sky onto Mount Sinai and that's what we knew, I would be persuaded by those arguments. But that's not how God gave the law. God sets the law in the context of this great story that begins with who God is and invites us into a relationship with Him. And the commandments understood in that context, they're not arbitrary at all. They are fulfillments of the fundamental truth that life is better together. So we're gonna begin not at all with the commands. We're going to begin by talking about who God is. And we're going to end not at all with those commands, but with the life that God is inviting us into. And in the middle, we will see the proper place of those commands, the proper understanding of you shall not commit adultery, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. So we begin with who God is. And God is life together. God is life together. You all know how fairy tales end, right? And they all lived happily ever after, right? That's the dream. And what's so obvious, what's such a given, indispensable thing that we don't even have to say it, is they all lived happily ever after together. Right? It's not a fairy tale ending unless Cinderella and Prince Charming are together. It's not a fairy tale ending unless Anna and Elsa and Kristoff and Sven and Olaf with his little snow cloud are together. The best life, the happiest life, the good life is the together life. And you say, yes, those are children's stories. And I'm not claiming that there are actual people like Cinderella and Prince Charming, or that Olaf can really survive in the summer. I'm going to tell him. But those fairy tales are the sorts of stories we tell because they reflect the longing put in our hearts by God, who is the true fairy tale, who is life happily ever before and after, because he is life together, because God is not this one monolithic, distant thing, but his Father, Son, and Spirit living in perfect, unending, harmonious, faithful intimacy with one another. If you've got your Bible, turn actually to John chapter 15. And this is going to be kind of our home text for understanding these commandments in their proper place. Even though it doesn't use the word adultery or the word lie, it helps us and gives us a context. And I'm going to read just verses 9 and 10 right now. This is Jesus speaking to disciples, speaking to people like you and me. This is what Jesus says. As the Father, as God the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments, and I abide in his love. Do you notice the flow of thought there? We start with the love that the Father has for the Son and how the Son has abided in the Father's love, and then an invitation from Jesus to you to abide in his love in the same way. And then we get to the commandments, right? But we don't stop at the commandments, right? They're a way station on the way through this text. As you keep the commandments, what happens? You abide in Jesus' love. Just as Jesus has kept the Father's commandments and abide in his, the Father's love. The story of the law begins and ends with the Father's love. It begins with the Father's love for Jesus, the true and eternal and perfect Son, and it ends with the Father's love for you and I, the adopted sons and daughters. And the commandments, they just grease the wheels. They're the interstate. They're getting us where we go. They're an invitation into life together. And again and again, in this short passage and throughout the Gospel of John, Jesus' word for this is abide. Abide. That's a word that means most basically stay at somebody else's house. But please don't think Airbnb. It is so much more than that. To abide is to be the guest of honor, to be the beloved, to dwell, to remain, to rest, to lie down in safety. It evokes all of the rich hospitality, the ancient world. If you come to stay in my house, there are no time limits. There are no conditions. It is understood that I will break myself financially to feast you. That's what abiding is. It's life together. Last year, we traveled back to North Carolina to our old stomping grounds, and we stayed in the town of Black Mountain for a week, and we abided in our friend's house, Nick and Nikki's. And it was nothing like an Airbnb. It was abiding. They have little kids. We have little kids. It was crazy, but it was entirely life together. We cooked together, we watched over each other's children, we borrowed their car without interruption for a week because it had enough seatbelts for our crazy family. They showered affection on us, fed us wonderfully. I followed Nick around to work because it was like, I get 1 week with my brother Nick, not wasting it, hanging out while he's off going to work. I go follow him, watch him be a contractor. don't really care about contracting, but I love Nick and I wanted to abide with him. This is who God is, and it's the life he's inviting us into. And the flow that includes the law is the love of God to the law, back to the love of God. That's how this works. God is life together. He's the best kind of life, and he's inviting you into life together. And to do that, in order to draw you up into better life, into life together, God gives us, gives his children good gifts. God, the loving Father, is a giver of good gifts. And he gives many, many gifts. He gives life itself. He gives himself. He gives his Holy Spirit. But the two gifts that we're talking about today, because they're the two gifts addressed by these commandments, are the gift of language and the gift of sex. God, our good Father, gives us the gift of language and he gives us the gift of sex for life together. Language is a gift for life together. You can know infinitely more about Shakespeare than you can know about cavemen. Right? Cavemen, we can know some things. They left tools laying around. They left paintings on walls. We can learn some things. But Shakespeare had language. He had words he could write. So you can inhabit his imagination. He lived 400 years ago, 8,000 miles away. And you can know his thinking. Neurons fired in Bill Shakespeare's brain in the late 16th century. And we know the effects. Language draws us together. This is why, for its whole history, humanity has devoted itself to the art of letter writing. Because in a world that separates us across time and space, letters are lifelines that hold us together. So whether you look just later in this book and read a letter like Paul's letter to the Philippians, and you can hear Paul dripping with joy and longing and life and his desire to be together. Or you fast forward centuries and you read the letters that we still have that went back and forth between John and Abigail Adams. John Adams, the second president, his wife Abigail. And the love and longing that's there, the language draws us together across boundaries that should be insurmountable. God's given us this gift. And we've perfected it, right? Now I don't have to write that whole long letter. I can just get on my phone and go, sup. And it's a lifeline. No. Language draws us together. Every time you open your mouth is a chance to celebrate life together and to create and cultivate life together. To give just a little word of encouragement. You notice a strength or an effort in somebody around you, and you acknowledge it and celebrate it with language, and you're drawn together. Or you notice somebody struggling, and you have nothing more profound or important to say than, hey, I see you. You're not alone. And your words create life together. Or you pray for somebody, not say, hey, I'll pray for you, but actually pray for somebody. To be prayed for is to be drawn together. It cultivates life. It builds intimacy. Even criticism done out of love, done well, can craft life together. Your questions, your invitation to another person to use language, your willingness to give them your full attention and listen, to say, how are you? Not like, hey, how are you? Right? But actually sit in front of someone and invite them to speak. Words build life together. You can just, because somebody's wondering it, you can use untrue words for life together. The life-cultivating answer is, no, Mr. Nazi, there are no Jews in my basement. That's bearing false witness for your neighbor. You're cultivating and creating life together. This is the purpose of language. This is the gift that God has given us. God is a communicator. It's shot. I mean, this is a 1,200-page book that he wrote with words. He called himself at the beginning of the service. We read it, the Word. Or just verse 11, right after what we read. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. Language ties us not just to one another, but to God himself, the original linguist, the original poet. This is the gift of language. God gives it to us for the creating of life together. He does the same thing with sex. Sex is a gift from God to create and cultivate life together. It is the good and right seal upon the marriage covenant between a man and a woman, so that when I join with my wife in sex, it's not just an animalistic mechanical act, but I am declaring to her that I will have the same faithfulness that God has shown to his bridegroom. I am here now and always. I am with you and I am for you. That's what sex at its best does. It is this kind of building up mountaintop of life together, which can also lead to more life together. Being fruitful and multiplying in the best sense of the word. It is a gift from God to cultivate this. And because it is so thoroughly and frequently misunderstood, let's talk about the right nature of this gift. Sex is a gift for life together. It is not the gift for life together. It is a culmination and a mountaintop. It is not the mountain and the mountaintop. It is entirely possible to experience the great fullness of life together without ever having sex. If you are 22 or 32 or 72 and thinking, gosh, I'm really getting up there to still be a virgin. Jesus has had a body for 2,000 years. And is the absolute fullness of life together. And has been a single virgin for every single one of those days. Sex is not indispensable. It is good. It is wonderful. But you are not missing out on life. So you can be single and taste the fullness of life together. You can be married and need to abstain from sex. Maybe one of the spouses has a medical issue that requires it. Maybe your spouse was molested or sexually abused. And the way that you can use your sexuality to cultivate and create life together is to say, I need you to know that I am here for you and not your body. And so I am deciding that for the next month or the next year, we're not going to do this. Until you understand and can receive it as, I am here for you, not I'm using you. Sex is a good and wonderful gift. It is not the gift. Right? There's that misunderstanding where we make too much of sex. There's also the misunderstanding that's maybe more prevalent in the church, has been throughout history, where, okay, fine, sex is a gift, but it's kind of a lump of coal gift. Right? It's, ugh. Yeah, he said be fruitful and multiply. So I guess we have to, right? Like a cow mounted by a bull. Just get it over with, please. I need to get back to the grass. Sex is really good. It is made as this mystical flesh and soul ecstasy. So you're not just hearing this from your weirdo pastor. Turn in your Bible to Song of Songs, because you all look entirely too comfortable. And I'm going to read starting halfway through chapter 4, verse 16, through the first few verses of chapter 5. This is a song about sexual union. And if you hear something and you think, is that a metaphor? The answer is, oh yeah. This is first the woman is singing, then the man, then others are cheering them on, and then the woman is singing again. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. I came to the garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk. Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love. I slept, but my heart was awake, a sound. My beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolt. God is not a prude. He did not give you a lump of coal. This is something to be celebrated and relished and enjoyed. God is a good father who gives good gifts to his children for the creating and cultivating and celebrating of life together. Language and sex are good gifts from a good God to give us the best life. And now we're ready to talk about the rules. Now we're ready to talk about the commandments. What the rules do is say, don't abuse God's good gifts. Don't misuse or undermine the good gifts your Father has given you. Every good gift is given for a purpose. If I give you a good book and you use it as fire starter, I mean, that's technically a use for it, right? And it's creating light and warmth. But that is an abuse, a misuse of the gift, and you should not be shocked if I'm a little disappointed. God's good gifts are given for a purpose. They are meant to create life, to create union, to create joy, as Jesus said in John 15. And they are not meant to be twisted around so that they create death, so that they create division, so that they create despair, which is exactly what adultery and lying do. When we abuse God's good gifts, when we break these commandments, we take things that were made for life together and we use them to facilitate life apart. We turn them on their heads. So we'll do language first. God gives us this gift of language, and then he says, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. This is kind of the extreme caricatured lying situation, because in the ancient world, you could accuse your neighbor of something they didn't do, be the only witness, and have them receive the full penalty for the crime. You were able to commit that kind of injustice with your words, to facilitate that kind of division and despair, and yes, even death in the ancient world, just with what you said. And that's obviously wrong, but what's wrong about it? What's really so bad about I solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Here's not the truth. Well, I know that sounds off, but what's going on? There's a number of things wrong here, right? The first is that we're creating division. To lie is to facilitate life apart. Because whatever, if I lie to Tim, whatever connection he and I have, it's either now fraught with distrust because Tim knows I lied, or even worse, if he doesn't realize that I lied, it's built on a false trust, where he's not actually relating to Zach, he's relating to this picture that he has of somebody kind of like Zach. What was meant to create life together, language actually ends up fraying life apart. That's what's wrong with it. What's wrong with it is that deceit, that lying is degrading to everyone involved. It says, you're not worthy of my trust, and I can't be trusted. Every time you lie, that's what is being done. But the worst part of it is neither of those things, because we're all on that. We're just kind of on the flat human level. The worst part about deceit is that we misrepresent God. The worst part about abusing words is that in doing so, we don't just lie about what we happen to be lying about. We lie about who God is. God is entirely faithful. He is entirely true. He is entirely forthcoming. There is no deceit in him, and we are made to bear his image, to join him in life together. So when I tell you, actually, 205, I am saying God is not honest. I was made to reflect God, and I am reflecting dishonesty. That's what's wrong with it, which is why we're not just talking about bearing false witness. There's all manner of forms of dishonesty. There's false encouragement. There's compliments given, not because they're true, but just because, you know, this is the point in the conversation where I say something nice. There's silence. When words, the good gift of God, should be used to cultivate life together. And I choose not to speak out of resentment, frustration, despair. I take God's good gift and twist it around in the same way as if I were on the witness stand. There's being passive-aggressive, saying something that is kind of vaguely related to what you mean, but isn't what you mean. To turn to your household member or your friend and say, would you like to go out to lunch? And what you mean is, did you hear Zach talking about Extendo Burgers? I would like to go out to lunch. Would you please come with me? That seems innocuous enough, but that's taking words to create division. It's misrepresenting God. This good gift that we've been given, language, it can be abused in dozens of ways. And so Jesus says in Matthew 5, in the passage Marta wrote, it's not just don't lie. It's be so honest, so utterly true, so reflective of God's honesty, that you would never have to take an oath. You would never have to say, to tell you the truth, implied, I don't always, but now I am. Or, honestly, for once. But just everything that comes out of your mouth, be the truth, to be trustworthy. My older children, they're reaching the age where saying to them, don't lie, isn't enough. Because they are... they're in first and third grade, and they're discovering the wonderful world of humor. Right? And the lowest shelf in the world of humor is always mockery. And so I can't teach them, you can't use this word, you can't do this joke, you can't say this thing. It's too many don'ts. They have to understand the fullness of the gift of language. Haley, God has given you the privilege of speaking, that you might speak words of grace, that you might speak the truth in love. If she doesn't grasp that, the goodness of God, the wonder of life together, the gift of language, she'll have no hope of even understanding the commandment, much less following it. All the same things that we just said about language, they can all be said about sex. All right, certainly adultery is the caricature extreme case. If you commit adultery, you are taking God's good gift that was made for life, union, and joy, and you are driving it straight at death and division and despair. And all the same things are wrong with it, right? It creates division. Even if your spouse stays faithful, stays true, images Jesus in a way that you haven't, there are wounds there that are not going to heal overnight. Walls it will take years to tear down. You create division. You degrade everyone involved. Here, the spouse actually comes out the best because their degrading is, I don't think you're worth it. But you and the person you're committing adultery with, you've taken down to the level of animals. This is just about me and me feeling good and my self-fulfillment. We're slightly less hairy apes. And worse all, again, you misrepresent God. You say, as I am faithless to her, so Jesus is to his bride. Your sexuality was given to you as a reflection of, as a participation in the divine life together. And when you twist it around, you don't just harm yourself. You mar the image of God. So again, this, we're not just talking about, I am married to her, I've been having sex with her. All manner of sexual distortion and misconduct has the same fundamental issues. I mean, I can just say rape and prostitution and trafficking, and we can picture the rest for those, right? But the subtler stuff too, right? Lust and pornography and masturbation. So the same kind of division, the same kind of degradation. And mar the image of God by saying, just as she exists for my titillation, God has made us to use us for titillation. No. What are you saying about God when you engage in casual sex? Jesus might stop by for a quick fling? Or when you cohabitate but refuse to enter into covenant marriage, Jesus is around for a while, but he wants an easy out in case something better comes along. Or what about, this doesn't come up a lot, what about bad sex in a marriage? Don't buy the church lie that as long as you don't and then get married and do, everything's fine. You can, husbands and wives can use one another sexually. If you can corner any married couple and get them to be honest, they'll tell you stories about sex where they ended far further apart than when they began. Because we go into it, I need to get something from you. As if Jesus came to get something from us. Instead of, Jesus came to give himself to me in life together. And now I get to do the same for you. We've been given this gift to image and reflect his beauty, to participate in his life together. We take these gifts that were made for life together and we turn them into life part. That's why the commandments are given. They're signs at the top of a cliff saying, turn around. You're headed toward death and you're leaving life behind. Take these words, take this sexuality and put it to God, honoring Jesus, imaging life together. Those aren't arbitrary rules. Those are invitations to be alive. This is the story, right? God is, he's made us for life together because he is life together. That's the design, and it haunts us. We see that not just in the end of fairy tales, but in romantic comedies. In the longing in our hearts, the intuitive understanding that we're not made to be alone. And yet, you certainly can read the Bible, but you don't have to realize that something's gotten off. You can study history, you can examine your own personal experience. We don't live together in this way. We spend so much time apart. In our culture, we take all of this money and spend it like crazy to buy life apart. Give me a bigger house on a bigger lot where I'm further away from my neighbors and my family members. How much does it cost? I don't care. It'll be easier. Blaise Pascal, the French mathematician, he said, there's a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every human being. That we were made for this life together, and yet we don't have it. The God who is life together is missing from us. Julian Barnes, who lived more recently is an atheist, he said it a little differently and even more poignantly. He said, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. There's something not here that should be here. And this lust and this lying and 1,000 other things, what we're trying to do is paper over the cracks. Conjure up some other form of life. We'll get to the John 15 text again in a moment, but what's happening is we're trying to live as branches ripped off of the vine. I'm away from Jesus. I'm away from life together. Let me make something kind of like life. And it's insane, right? We're trying to get life together by driving as fast as we can toward life apart. It makes no sense at all, but this is what we engage in. Recently, scientists have found the cure for drug addiction. It's actually quite simple. They figured this out using mice. If you put a mouse alone in a maze with a heroin drip, you know, one of the most powerfully addictive substances in the world, the mouse would get addicted to heroin. Take a little bit and a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. If you take away the heroin drip, the mouse will just curl up in a ball and wait to die. But if you leave the heroin drip and introduce a bunch of other mice into the maze, the mouse will forget about the heroin drip. It's right there in his face, the addictive substance that he needed just days ago. He's not interested anymore. Walks right by it again and again and again. Why? Life together. The answer to that overwhelming, consuming addiction is life together. Our lust and our deceit, those are our forms of heroin. Those are how we get through days of life apart. And Jesus has come, not just to command us, don't do that, but to give us power over those things. Jesus didn't just come and say, hey, tell the truth. He came and said, in me, you need never lie again. He didn't just come and say, hey, be faithful to your spouse or pure in your singleness. He came and said, in me, you need never lust again. Let's turn back to John 15 and see this. And I'm going to read most of 1 through 11, and you'll see this tension of what we were made for and what we turn away from, and Jesus inviting us back to life together. Jesus says this, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. Skip down to verse 9. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full. Brothers and sisters, Jesus did not just come to be a road sign saying, hey, don't go over the cliff, turn around. He came to carry you into life together. I can stand up here all day and say, hey, don't lust and don't lie. And you can completely agree with me. And you will go home and lust and lie. Because we have not at all addressed why. We haven't gotten to the root. Why do you lie? Is it so that people will believe you're 205? To hide some shame? Get approval or a job or a little bit more money that you believe you need? Maybe it's something else entirely. In Jesus, all of those things are offered to you. He knows who you are and has come to live with you. You don't have to hide anything from him. He delights in you and offers you security in his forever kingdom. wealth and worthy work beyond your imaginings. You don't have to scrap and claw and deceive and fix up the resume. Why do you lust? I'll just tell you in first person, it's not about the orgasm for me. It's about being James Bond. It's about being somebody. Somebody that women would just be barely able to control themselves around. Then I would be somebody. Jesus doesn't just come and say, "Hey, Zach, don't do that." He comes and says, "I have decided that you are somebody. I died for you. I've prepared a place in my house for you. Come and live with me." Ladies, y'all are great, but if I have that from Jesus, I don't need it from you. Jesus is not just coming to say, "Cut it out." He's coming to be the vine, to be the conduit of life that draws up the water and the nutrients and the glory from the ground and feeds it into each and every branch that you might come alive in him and bear the kind of fruit, the kind of life you could never bear on your own. Whatever it is that you're hunting, whatever it is that you're after when you lie, when you deceive, when you lust, when you manipulate, Jesus has come to say, "I have all of those things. I am all of those things. And I have been hunting you so that we might live together." Brother, sister, lay down your attempts to fake life. Receive the good gifts of your loving Father. Words and sex, but most of all, receive Jesus, who is life. And be drawn up into the best kind of life. Into life together.